It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to an epidemiologist about his healthcare efforts in the Native American communities around the state. First, we're getting an update on Wisconsin's 6,000 untested rape kits. In September, the State Department of Justice received a $4 million grant to address the problem, but almost 4 months later, it looks like there hasn't been much progress. Keegan Kyle has been following the story. He's an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network in Wisconsin. Keegan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's back up a second and talk about all of these untested rape kits. Where you've been trying to find out, where are they around the state? So where are they? What police departments have a lot of them?
There's a lot of them. There's, like you said, more than 6,000 across the state, or at least we last surveyed, there were more than 6,000. They're in police departments big and small, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, all across the state. Any department that has evidence rooms is capable of like storing these types of kits. So they're just all over the place. It's not in one department or just two or something like that.
Well, tell us why people are making the case that we need to get these kits tested.
The broad idea is that they can be tested now and linked up with DNA databases to try to identify suspects or to help people in crime cases or even where suspects have already been identified. These types of kits can add credibility to victim claims, or they can link cases together through DNA. And so there are a lot of reasons why, especially victim advocates, have pushed for getting all these types of kits tested.
Right, because the case could be that either someone has already pled guilty, or the victim has dropped the claim, so the kit might go untested because it's not needed as evidence in this particular trial. The idea here is it may have more importance than that. It might help solve other cases, find potential serial sexual assaulters.
Yeah, exactly. The state of Wisconsin has been there are a lot of different approaches to this. The state has really been resistant to the idea of testing all the cases necessarily. They've wanted to kind of prioritize and go through them as based on which ones are most urgent. You know, things where it's a case like there's a statute of limitations coming up or they'd have no suspect. You know, those are particularly urgent cases where the kits want to be tested. And right now, the state is still trying to evaluate and prioritize all those 6,000, you know, which ones are people are already in jail and serving out their sentence, and which ones are we don't have a suspect yet identified.
So we knew there was this problem, this backlog in testing. Tell us about this $4 million grant. How did the state get that, and what was it supposed to do?
Yeah, the state applied for it. $2 million came from New York prosecutors, and $2 million came from the U.S. Department of Justice. And half the money is going just for basically testing kits. You know, it costs about $1,000 per kit to test, and so it can get pretty expensive. The other half of the money was meant to kind of fund more systemic solutions to this type of issue, to fund a full-time team that was helping victims, that was researching and tracking cases, and tracking kits throughout the process and also helping victims through that process. And those are the two things that haven't quite, you know, gained a lot of momentum in the past few months.
Talking to Keegan Kyle and about his reporting on untested rape kits here in Wisconsin. Yeah, that's in September this grant was received. It was announced then. And not much movement on either of those things you just mentioned, on either testing more of the kits or on forming this committee to make sure that we don't have this backlog in the future.
Yeah, I think, you know, Wisconsin is different than a lot of states in that it has been proactive in addressing this. You know, 2 years ago, they did their first survey to kind of look at how many untested rape kits were out there. And then last year, they got this really big boost in funding, but they just haven't, at least in September, you know, made a lot of strides. There are the Milwaukee Police Department and the Madison Police Department are two that have started sending some of their kits to a crime lab for testing. But there are hundreds other of kits across the state that are still just sitting on shelves.
Did you hear anything from the State Department of Justice about why it might be taking a bit longer than expected to get these things rolling?
Yeah, one of the issues that they raised is a hiring issue, which is that, you know, they received this grant money to build kind of a team to lead this project, but they just haven't been able to fill those positions yet. And that team was kind of charged with prioritizing the kits and then deciding which ones are going to get tested. And if you don't have the people kind of making those decisions, the entire process gets stalled. So that's been a pretty key step that hasn't happened yet. And it's prevented some other things like happening too, like the creation of a hotline that victims could call and kind of get an easy update on the status of their kits and whether there's been hits on them or things like that.
Is there a notion that this team will be in place anytime soon?
Yeah, I do think in talking with the Department of Justice, they recognize this as a high priority, and they are looking to make this happen soon. It's just, like they told me, the wheels of government don't always go, you know, as fast as they would hope. So they are working on it, though.
You mentioned that the state previously hadn't seen testing every kit as a priority, but victims groups you mentioned do. They're hoping every kit gets tested. Is there a sense that the state now is moving in that direction, at least closer to testing all or almost all of these kits?
No, I don't think so. Their approach has been to really ask victims whether they want their kits to be tested and to kind of give them discretion. So if they look at it as like they don't want to push someone into the criminal justice system if they don't want to be there. So if someone provided a kit 2 years ago or years ago and now does not want to have that kit tested, the state, I believe, is going to respect that wish and not move it forward.
That's my understanding that this is not a Wisconsin-only problem. Other states, other major cities have similar backlogs. Is Wisconsin particularly bad? Are we a standout when it comes to this backlog of untested rape kits?
I don't know. The only really barometer I have for that is, you know, last summer, Wisconsin, in part of a USA Today network, you know, identified that there were at least 70,000 kits across the entire country. So I guess that's one way of looking at it as, you know, we're not like the only ones out there, or we're not necessarily a huge chunk of that number. 6,000 out of 70,000 is significant, but it's not like, you know, we're half or anything near that.
So when you take this backlog of untested kits and you hear from victims groups and the states, are people thinking there are unsolved cases, there are offenders at large now because of this backlog of untested kits?
I don't know. When you talk with local police departments, I think there's a sense there's not a lot of certainty that testing these kits will really identify new perpetrators. Because they always have had that judgment whether to send these kits in or not. And in talking with them about why anecdotally some of their kits haven't been tested, they cite cases where, you know, offenders are already serving their sentence and they're merely holding on to this kit for legal reasons. Or they are holding on to kits in case a victim changes their mind and wants to test it. So I guess that's maybe a long way of saying that it's a little unclear whether this is going to generate a lot of hit. I did ask the Department of Justice whether any of the Madison or Milwaukee cases that have been submitted have generated hits so far, and they said they didn't know. So, but that's definitely a question on everybody's mind is, you know, are we going to get a ton of new suspects because these cases are working through the system now?
Keegan, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
That's Keegan Kyle. He's an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network in Wisconsin. Amy DeLong works within and for her tribal community at the Ho-Chunk House of Wellness in Baraboo. She pursued medicine as a way to find more fulfilling work for herself and to give back to her community.
My name is Amy DeLong, and I'm a family physician at the Ho-Chunk Nation House of Wellness Clinic. when I was volunteering at the university hospital, and I was a college student. So this was a little Lakota girl, and she said, "You could be my sister." From that point on, when she introduced me to the other hospital staff, she'd say, "This is my sister." Just by virtue of being American Indian and just that connection, that instant connection, we didn't have to be from the same tribe, but just to say, "Hey, there's someone like me who's here at a time when I'm vulnerable."
Good. Stick your tongue out.
So I've had these little experiences along the way that just said, it's really important for me to work in an American Indian community. And part of that was I didn't see any American Indian physicians growing up. So it was just really important for me to be that, you know, when my community members go to the clinic or to the hospital, they're going to have a Native physician who's taking care of them. That was always the goal, to go back to where I came from, really, and work for my tribe. I want my patients to be able to say, "This is my physician, and she's Ho-Chunk, and she gets me."
Are you ready to see your labs? All-time low.
What?
All-time low. Look at you. 7.3.
Yo.
That is awesome.
I love my job. I love what I do. I see elders. I see children. I see pregnant women, patients who have diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, depression. One thing I always say about working in a primary care clinic is every day I'm inspired by my patients or some story they share with me.
Well, with what's going on in my life with my son,
mm-hmm.
I get like started smoking really bad, like a pack a day.
Is that where you still are?
No.
It's really the people who live in chaos, like I did as a child, and who are making the most of it.
Yeah, and then good luck with home stuff, family stuff.
When you see people and their strength and how they deal with whether it's an abusive relationship or a substance abuse problem and how they're really working hard to lead a healthier life, it's amazing. I think that's the gift of being a physician. People tell you their life stories. They tell you things that they wouldn't tell other people. The patients don't even realize how inspiring it is to those of us who are listening.
And that's it, Elena. You did great. And then we just...
This story was produced by Finn Ryan for We Are Healers. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. Joining us now to talk more about efforts to improve health care of Native Americans in our region is Isaiah Brokenleg. He's an epidemiologist and the program director at the Great Lakes Intertribal Epidemiology Center. Isaiah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, we just heard in that Wisconsin Life, a Native American physician who had this strong sense of mission here. Do you personally feel that too? Is that part of why you're an epidemiologist doing what you're doing?
Well, I definitely feel a strong sense of mission. I kind of took a roundabout way to get here, but I care a lot about the communities that I serve. And ever since I was young growing up, everybody's like, get an education, come back and help your people. That's very common. You'll hear grandparents and parents saying that.
And so what do you do? What does an epidemiologist do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, there's kind of two kinds, basically. There's like one kind that does more surveillance. That's probably the more common one. We look at rates of disease and health and how to improve that. And then there's the sort of kind you think of when you watch TV about, like, you know, an outbreak or something like that, that like flies in the little suit and responds and that kind of stuff. That's a different type. But both are important.
So what are some of your...
On a day-to-day basis.
Oh, sure.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask, what are some of your key priorities now at the Great Lakes Intertribal Epidemiology Center? What are the issues that you're really focusing on?
Well, we have epidemiologists. We have several. One of them focuses on chronic disease. One of them focuses on maternal child health. One of them focuses on behavioral health. Another one on environmental health. And so we have all of those focuses. I focus on, like, health promotion and disease prevention through a specific grant from the CDC.
And we've talked to you in the past about some of the history behind the culture, damage done to Native American culture over time that really is still playing itself out in health and mental health issues today. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, I think that's talking about historical trauma and how sort of you remove the cultural DNA, all the things that we learn from our culture over time that's passed on from your parents or grandparents or aunties and uncles. When you remove that, then there's this damage done, and until that damage gets fixed, it will continue to perpetuate itself throughout generations. And I think you can see that, and also, like, separately, there's, like, structural violence that occurs, you know, based on decisions that were made by governments that continue to this day. The Indian Health Service is incredibly underfunded. For every dollar they need, they get about 56 cents. And they tend to run out of money in about June, when that money is supposed to last all the way until the end of September. So it's really difficult. And you'll see really great health disparities between, like, Wisconsin as a whole and then American Indians, especially with cancer, cardiovascular issues, substance abuse, and with the younger population, suicide is a very serious problem.
We're talking to Isaiah Brokenleg. He's an epidemiologist looking at health issues and health access for Native Americans in Wisconsin. So with those shortfalls in funding, Isaiah, I mean, this issue of access, how hard is it for Native Americans to find anything from preventive care to substance abuse or mental health treatment?
Well, mental health treatment is definitely a serious problem. Folks have difficulty finding treatment facilities. There's not very many that are available. There's a long wait list, and, you know, if somebody wants to get treatment, you know, telling them they're going to have to wait 6 months is not really the answer, and by then they might be on a totally different path in their life. You need to get them in right away, and that's one of the problems. I think there's also just the problem of it being so rural. You know, in many cases, some of the communities, you might have to travel a half hour just to get to a clinic and be seen, and then if you're also dealing with issues of poverty, trying to get to that clinic is a whole other issue. And sometimes other things, like being able to get food on the table and other things, will take priority over making a clinic appointment, for example.
So that's a bread and butter type issue, just resources and available access to health care. But talking about the historical trauma issues again, I understand you have some training tools for digital storytelling, things like that, to help people reconnect with the cultural narrative to start trying to overcome some of that historical trauma.
Yeah, I think when people tell their stories, it's a very healing process. It certainly was for me. I have several stories up on YouTube, but we go into communities and work with them to tell their story, or at least one of their stories, because most people have many. And so some of the tools we use are something called a story circle. We have laptops that we bring in, and people usually bring photos, and they kind of write a narrative of one piece of their life and share that. And a lot of them are done on different topics, like tobacco or food access or domestic violence. We've seen a lot of different ones that have come up. And some of the stories are sad, and some of them are very empowering. But everybody that's gone through that process that I've talked to definitely talks about how powerful of an experience it was and how it really helped them feel empowered as a human being.
Well, in our last minute and a half or so, Isaiah, you mentioned the roundabout story that led you going into healthcare. Can you give us a taste of that story, and maybe it's something that could inspire other people to follow in your footsteps?
Absolutely. So I really didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated college, and I thought I wanted to do social work, and I missed the deadline for the School of Social Work. And I got recruited by the School of Public Health, and he's like, you can still do school social work, just do the 1 year of public health, and then you could do the dual degree. And by the time I finished that 1 year of public health, I was like, I'll just stay in public health. But I think what I really think is important for people to know is that, especially young American Indian folks, is, you know, I didn't go to college until I was 21, and life is not a race. So even if maybe you don't have everything together or college is not right right now, it's definitely right in the future. And whatever you enjoy doing, whether it be video games or English or you want to be a lawyer, there's a place in the health field for all of those things. You know, we need policy and administration folks. We need public health lawyers. There's all kind of new surgical things that use computer to get in and help people and heal them. So there's something for everybody.
We'll leave it there for now. Isaiah, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking to Isaiah Brokenleg. He's an epidemiologist, and he's the program director at the Great Lakes Intertribal Epidemiology Center. Last year was the 60th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision that ruled separate schools for white and black students to be unconstitutional.
That decision began a desegregation process that lasted years and brought the depths of American racism into the national spotlight. Black children received death threats and found mobs blocking their entrance into segregated schools. Armed troops had to forcibly desegregate campuses across the South.
One group of students at the center of that tense time in American history is known as the Little Rock Nine. They were the nine African-American students selected to desegregate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. After being prevented from entering the school by a mob and the Arkansas National Guard, President Dwight Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne to Little Rock to escort them into the school. This is a report from the time outside Central High.
This is Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas. Troops, which for nearly 3 weeks lined the sidewalk here in front of the high school under orders to keep the colored students out, have been replaced now, and their orders to comply with the law, which means let the Negro students in if they come in.
We were Terrence Roberts, Jefferson Thomas, Thelma Mothershed, Elizabeth Eckford, Ernest Green, Carlotta Walls, Melba Patillo, Minnie Jean Brown, and Gloria Ray.
The youngest of the Little Rock Nine, Carlotta Walls Lanier, is in Wausau today. She'll be speaking at Wausau East High School tomorrow at 6:30 p.m., and she joins us now. Carlotta, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, for a long time, you didn't write or talk much about your experience at Little Rock Central High. Why not?
That's correct. Well, I'm sure it was more about how painful the time was. I wanted to just push that into the recesses of my mind and not relive those days.
It's interesting that even today you think of them as so painful, which I'm sure that they were, but your actions there, along with the aid of your cohort there, are viewed right up there with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and Rosa Parks not getting off the bus. Does the pain still outweigh the pride?
No, I've been fortunate enough to finally get it on paper, and I have a book called A Mighty Long Way, My Journey to Justice at Little Rock Central High School, and with that, I was able to put that time, express myself more openly through this book as my memoir. So it was very cathartic for me to write the book.
Now, when most people think of the Little Rock Nine, images of the guard escorting you into school come to mind, but your journey, it started well before that. How did you decide to volunteer? How did you become one of the Little Rock Nine, one of the first African Americans to desegregate Central High in Arkansas?
Well, it really, the credit goes to my parents. The credit also goes to those black teachers that I had in elementary school and in junior high school. The community that I grew up in, I was always told that even though we were being considered second-class citizens, that we weren't, that we was just as good as the next person, that we could learn like anyone else, and in the future things were going to change, and education was the key to success. So that was my foundation, basically, that I knew that I was an equal, even though I was in a separate but equal environment.
And when you first tried to enter the school in early September of that year, you were prevented. What was that particular day like for you?
Oh, it was somewhat chaotic. The Arkansas National Guard was there to keep us out. However, we were under the impression they were there to protect the citizens of Little Rock. And I surely considered myself a citizen. My father paid taxes like everyone else, had served in World War II, as had honors on the battlefield. And so it was a day of reckoning. Once we got there, we discovered that the Arkansas National Guard was really there to keep us out and not to really protect us. As far as they were concerned, to protect us, we needed to go home.
At that moment, did you realize that this was going to be maybe more than you had thought it would be in the beginning? I mean, obviously you knew this was going to be tough going in, and you knew that you would be up against some resistance. But did you realize at that point the extent of what you were going to have to find within yourself to overcome?
Well, I knew that there was a segment of people who really did not want us at the school. But I also felt that humankind would overrule some of that, and that group of people would finally probably dissipate, just move away and recognize that this was the law and they should be law-abiding citizens. And they were expressing their displeasure of us attending that particular school, but I didn't think that it would last as long as it did. I thought in a week or so that it would be over with. As far as the group that were located across the street, you know, with the name calling, with all of the derisive names, the hatefulness, the harassment, and so forth.
And when you did get to enter the school, it was, in fact, it's hard to wrap your head around any of it. We have some recordings of it, which I think give the best example, because it's even hard to describe with words what it was like. So let's listen to a little bit about that day.
Sure.
We just got a report here on this end that the students are in. That's right. Turn the key down that way, Don. Down there. You can see from here some of the action occurring down there.
And there you were at the center of that maelstrom. What did that first day feel like once you were actually inside the building and through all of those screaming mobs?
Yeah, that was September 23rd. We didn't stay the full day. And to be honest with you, I did not see that. We had, or hear that. We had entered the school in a side door, and what you heard was someone reporting that we were inside. See, that was probably, you know, 9 o'clock that day. And I was in my third class by that time when the mob was just upset with the fact that we were inside the school. We did not stay that full day. That is when the police had to move us out of the school. And because the 17 policemen that were assigned by the mayor to, you know, protect the property and the people there at the school could not hold back over 1,000 people there.
So you were aware, even while you were in those first classes of the day, you were aware that this was going on outside?
No, I was aware that the mob was there. I was not aware of all of... I was not aware of students jumping out of windows, leaving the school, that sort of thing. It was not until the news in the afternoon that I saw all of that on television.
Well, take us inside the school where you were. What was it like for you on that first day?
On that first, well, that's the first day that we got in, and on September 23rd. So, because September 4th was our first day, we never got past the National Guard. September 23rd, we were in, but we were taken out by noon. I went to my classes, and was assigned a seat and so forth. And I heard some, you know, nasty remarks and that sort of thing, but that was about it. Actually, our first full day was September 25th, and that was with the 101st Airborne.
Mm. You know, high school today can be miserable enough.
Right.
Cliques and bullying without all of the added racially motivated attacks that you were going through, both
right.
inside to a certain extent and outside the school. Mm-hmm. How did you cope and handle that from day to day?
Well, I stayed above it is what I did. I refused to bring myself down to that level of ignorance. I considered them those that did not agree with me being there. They had been influenced by some of adults and parents and so forth. They had been brought up in a segregated society. They had considered themselves privileged, and that I was invading their space. The nine of us were invading their school. I considered that rather on the ignorant side, to be honest with you. And I stayed above it mentally. That's how I got through it each day. The people spitting on you, throwing rocks at you, walking on the backs of your heels, in the hallways, all of those sort of things.
Well, we're speaking right now with Carlotta Wells Lanier, the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of students that desegregated Little Rock Central High in 1957. She's also the author of the book, A Mighty Long Way, My Journey to Justice at Little Rock Central High.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Carlotta about what it was like to go through this experience? Do you remember this era, the desegregation times in the 50s and 60s? Where were you? Were you involved somehow? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Carlotta Wells Lanier, the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of students that desegregated Little Rock Central High in 1957. She's in Wausau today, and she'll be speaking at Wausau East High School tomorrow at 6:30.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you remember desegregation in the 50s and 60s, watching it on TV, maybe being involved in it at the time? Do you feel like the country has come a long way since then, or is there still a lot of work to do when it comes to segregated neighborhoods or schools? And do you have a question for Carlotta Wells Lanier? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. Anne is joining us from the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Carlotta. I just want to say thank you for everything you've done and gone through. And my question for you is, at any point did any of your fellow students or teachers or anyone in the community ever apologize for their actions or try and make amends with you later?
In the late 80s, the nine of us were, actually it was seven out of the nine, was on Oprah Winfrey's show. And Oprah has a way of finding some of those people. And they were also a part of the show, which was a surprise to us. And there was one in particular, one man in particular, that asked for forgiveness and wanted to come up and give us a hug, and which we gladly received.
What about during...
I've had a couple of others, that, you know, via email or what have you, to reach out. But as far as complete apologizing, I think that the one that was on Oprah's show was the one that I can say definitely asked for an apology.
What about during your days at Little Rock Central High? Did any of the white teacher students reach out to you then, even in small ways?
Yes. You know, it was a reflection of our society to have a group of people who, I think, kids that and teachers that wanted to be friends, be friendlier. However, some were afraid as well to be harassed and bullied by those that were making it very miserable for us. There was a group that of teachers and students who wish we weren't there, period, and agreed with some of the segregationists. And then there was that silent majority, too, that just kept looking straight and not offering any assistance one way or another.
What you went through is so unfathomable to many of us who will never have to do that, or who piggyback on your acts of bravery then. Is it true what people say, that if you go through a trial by fire like that, that you do emerge stronger, or was there a price to be paid too?
Yeah, you come out, I think overall you come out stronger. And I agree too that it is a price that you pay. Our parents paid a price. A number of them lost their jobs. So, but at the same time, if you ask me, was it worth it? I would have to say yes, it was worth it, because we were upholding the law of the land, also the Constitution. We knew we had a right to be there.
We'll go back to the callers now. We've got Nicole joining us from Duluth, Minnesota. Nicole, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say thank you for this opportunity to engage in conversation with you. And I'm really curious, given your historical perspective and experience, can you talk a little bit about what you see in today's society in terms of racial injustice, and kind of speak to that given this wisdom that you have and experience from the past?
Well, I still see that there are unfounded fears of people who are different than you. I still see people who are closed-minded. I also see those who are more open-minded. I have hope that this younger generation will move in a stronger and more positive way than what I experienced. Unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. As I have said to some high school students that I have spoken to, I was moved by Emmett Till's murder. And today, kids, and still remember it, and remember it well. And our young people today will not forget a Trayvon Martin or a Mike Brown. Because basically it's some of the same things that are going on. So, however, we have a justice system that has improved, and it needs more improvement as far as that goes. But those are the sort of things that I think about in today's society.
Well, last year was the 60th anniversary of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision that ruled separate but equal schooling unconstitutional.
Yes.
And today, reports from UCLA and ProPublica show that schools are resegregating. Now,
yes.
As one of the women on the front lines of desegregation in 1957 and onward, what do you make of that?
Well, I see that as it relates to all the other areas of our society. The resegregation is really about economics is attached to that. People are resegregating or in neighborhoods and so forth because they can't afford whatever area they might want to be in. Why can't they afford the homes or the neighborhoods that they want to be in? Because they don't have the jobs that can afford that. Why is it that they don't have the jobs? Because they're not getting the best education available. Our educational system is broken in many places here in the United States. So we are not number one in the world anymore in educating our children. And I'm I'm despondent over that piece. We are blaming other groups of people who are coming to the United States for taking certain jobs. Well, they're taking them because they are prepared to take them. They are going to universities and learning what's necessary to do what we need. We are not using education as a number one priority in our country anymore, and we need to get back to that.
Now, here in Wisconsin, there are many African Americans and whites living in highly segregated areas who may go a long time, maybe a day, maybe more, without interacting with people who don't look like them. Mm-hmm. For example, Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the country. What's your advice to people who aren't used to living their lives with people who don't look like them?
Well, they need to open their minds and hearts and also take it as a challenge to understand and learn about someone else who does not look like you. Understand their culture. Understand their ethnic background. Understand their language. Not use that as a negative, but use it as a learning tool to understand more about them. Be a part of more dialogue, open dialogue. Not so much to be in a confrontational way, but to be open and to learn more about someone else. We can agree to disagree, but in a way that we are learning from each other.
I understand you've got two children now. They have the opportunity to live the rest of the story about civil rights and racial mm-hmm. equality in America. What do you want them and others to take away from your story about what you and the rest of the Little Rock Nine did?
Well, I want them to understand how this country was built, whose shoulders they're standing on. We are all standing on various shoulders. And with that, we should take it to the next level of enjoying the American way and all of the things that we have here in our country. I want my kids to be able to do the type of work that they want to do, to be able to buy in any neighborhood that they want. I want them to be competitive in this global society that we live in, and to learn from other people. So I encourage not only my kids, but all other kids that I speak to get all that they can possibly get, because, you know, you can learn as much as we are capable of learning all that we can. And, you know, that is something that no one can take away from you. That piece that you learn in the various schools and educational environments that you're involved in.
Carlotta, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
We've been speaking with Carlotta Walls Lanier, the youngest member of the Little Rock Nine, the group of students that desegregated Little Rock Central High in 1957. She's also the author of A Mighty Long Way, My Journey to Justice at Little Rock Central High. And she's in Wausau today. She'll be speaking at Wausau East High School tomorrow at 6:30 p.m.